Good afternoon. I'm Teresa Gabaldon, Professor of Law and Carville Dickinson Benson Research Professor of Law at the George Washington University Law School and host of the 2006 Fireside Chat Series presented by the Securities and Exchange Commission Historical Society. The Securities and Exchange Commission Historical Society, a nonprofit organization independent of and separate from the SEC, preserves and shares SEC and securities history through its virtual museum and archive at www.sechistorical.org. The Fireside Chats are one of the many online programs which the Society broadcasts live on www.sechistorical.org each year, and then preserves in both audio and transcript formats within the museum. All programs and materials in the museum are free and available worldwide 24/7. It's my privilege today to welcome back members of the staff of NERA Economic Consulting, presenting what have been deemed the top presentations from their recent Finance, Law, and Securities seminar. I began my society broadcast career in 2004 with the first Best of NERA online program, and it's good to be back for the third annual discussion. Joining me today are Dr. Elaine Buckberg, NERA Vice President, who was also a panelist on the first Best of NERA, Dr. Patrick Conroy, a Vice President with NERA Economic Consulting, and Dr. Fatin Sabri, also a NERA Vice President. The comments made today are solely those of the speakers and are not representative of the society. Our speakers cannot give investment or legal advice. I'd like to thank NERA Economic Consulting for its sponsorship of today's chat, as well as to acknowledge Pfizer Inc.'s generous support throughout this year for the 2006 Fireside Chat Series. As the SEC Historical Society receives no federal funding, the virtual museum and archive, including programs such as today's, are made possible solely by gifts and grants. Today's chat looks at some of the major issues in securities regulation today. These are disgorgement, options backdating, and mutual fund fees. I'd like to begin our discussion with Dr. Elaine Buckberg's comments on disgorgement. Elaine, it's good to have you back.
Thank you, Teresa. The SEC has long sought disgorgement from corporate executives involved in securities fraud, but this is only becoming more common. Sarbanes-Oxley has made this long-standing civil remedy mandatory for the CEO and CFO of any company restating its earnings due to material misrepresentations. Today I'll discuss the proper measurement of disgorgement from legal and economic perspectives. Both case law and economics support the calculation of disgorgement as the net economic gain from the alleged misconduct. In other words, disgorgement should be the difference between what the executive earned and what they would have earned in the absence of the fraud. Let me briefly review the standards for disgorgement. Disgorgement is intended to be a deterrent to fraud, designed to ensure that securities law violators do not keep their gains. However, disgorgement is an equitable remedy. As such, disgorgement itself cannot be punitive, although the court may impose penalties in addition to disgorgement, and those penalties are often calculated as some multiple of the disgorgement amount. Disgorgement is also not compensatory. The SEC can ask for disgorgement even if there are no identifiable victims, although the SEC typically will contribute any disgorged monies to a victim's compensation fund. In order for disgorgement to be equitable, it must be causally related to the fraud. Courts strictly enforce this requirement. This means that disgorgement of trading profits must be limited to gains prior to a corrective disclosure, consistent with the efficient markets hypothesis. Moreover, gains from the fraud must be offset by losses incurred through the same fraud. This kind of netting is routinely used in calculating damages in securities fraud as well as tax cases. The SEC takes the lead in a disgorgement case, typically quantifying its disgorgement demand in the complaint. The SEC typically will present the largest disgorgement figure the facts allow. And the SEC is entitled to disgorgement based on a showing of a reasonable approximation of a defendant's illegal profit. So that's fine under the law. And the courts will initially presume the SEC's initial demand to be reasonable. The burden then shifts to the defendant to present an alternative calculation and show that the SEC's calculation is not reasonable. If the defendant can demonstrate that the SEC's calculation is overly broad and fails to exclude amounts not causally related to the misconduct, the courts will often reject the SEC's calculation and reduce or eliminate the disgorgement award. That said, it's not sufficient for the defense to simply critique the SEC's calculation. In SEC versus Antar, the court ruled that the defense did not fulfill its burden because it did not present an alternative calculation or witnesses at the disgorgement phase of the trial. Now, what kind of unjust enrichment does the SEC seek to be disgorged? Sarbanes-Oxley specifies the disgorgement of incentive-based compensation, and there are three major types of incentive-based compensation. The first is cash bonuses based on financial performance. A company's compensation committee typically sets a formula at the beginning of the fiscal year, keying bonuses to earnings or earnings growth or some other measure of profitability. Moreover, for this to be an incentive plan, the executives are aware of the formula, and so in principle, if fraud were going on, they could attempt to game the formula. The SEC also asks for trading in stock or derivatives. The third major form of incentive compensation involves options grants. These could simply be affected by issues in the stock price, or fraud could include options backdating, which has been so much in the news in recent weeks and which my colleague Pat will discuss in a few minutes. The SEC might also seek disgorgement relating to below-market loans, as were prevalent in the Tyco case, and retirement benefits, which often key off bonuses. Let's break the net economic gain approach of calculating disgorgement into two major concepts. The first of those is netting of losses against gains. The second is market efficiency. Courts enforce the standard that only net gains be disgorged, and let me give you some examples. The first is SEC versus McCaskey. Now, McCaskey was a not very successful insider trader. He lost money. The SEC demanded disgorgement of his trading profits, his gross trading profits, ignoring his trading losses and the commissions he incurred during the manipulation. The district court disagreed with the SEC, however, and granted offsets. In fact, because he incurred net losses, there was no disgorgement. In SEC versus Credit Bancorp, the SEC demanded disgorgement of the gross revenues that were remitted to a trustee. However, the court halved this demand by deducting the necessary expenses incurred by the trustee to commit the fraud. For example, his office rent. It's worth noting that while the SEC did not net, in these cases, the SEC has provided for netting in its own proposals in compensating victims. And here I'd point you to SEC versus Wang. The amount disgorged was subsequently used in this case for a victim's compensation fund. And the SEC has claimants to demonstrate that they were net sellers during the fraud period as opposed to simply having sales. Moreover, to determine the amount that a shareholder claimant would receive from the proceeds of the disgorgement action, the SEC requested that the claimants compute their net losses involving both their losses from stock sales offset by profits from stock purchases. From an economic perspective, the legal requirement that disgorgement be causally related to the fraud has caused the courts to incorporate a presumption of market efficiency in disgorgement decisions. The efficient market hypothesis asserts that if a stock or other security trades in an efficient market, all information in the public domain will be incorporated in the price. If fraud occurs and is disclosed, the market will immediately reprice the stock based on the disclosure. For a defendant's trading gains to be causally related to the fraud, only those gains before the disclosure should be disgorged. Any gain subsequent to the disclosure cannot be the result of the fraud because it's already been disclosed. The presumption of market efficiency was, of course, decisively incorporated into securities law by the Supreme Court in Basic versus Levinson. And every disgorgement decision since Basic has adopted the efficient market hypothesis in determining disgorgement of trading gains or losses. In fact, disgorgement decisions, though, that predated Basic also were consistent with market efficiency. One of these is SEC versus Texas Gulf Sulfur. And here, the SEC came forth with a disgorgement recommendation that was consistent with market efficiency. They asked for disgorgement of profits up through the day in which the news came into the market and excluded the subsequent rise in the stock price while the defendants were still holding. The circuit affirmed this decision. Another case is SEC versus McDonald. And McDonald is an interesting case. He's an insider trader who purchased stock about 2 weeks prior to a disclosure of a merger announcement. He then held it for another year, so he made 19% up to the merger announcement and another 80% by holding for an additional year. The SEC asked for disgorgements of all of his gains up until a year after the disclosure. The circuit remanded the case, however, to the district with orders to cut off disgorgement within a reasonable time after the disclosure. In shareholder class action litigation, it's become conventional to use event studies in order to both demonstrate what price movement may be attributed to a disclosure, and therefore this is used in the calculation of damages. Similarly, event studies can be used in disgorgement cases. First, they can be used to demonstrate or disprove the materiality of the alleged disclosures, and two, to measure the price movement attributable to the disclosure and hence to the fraud. The SEC has also supported the use of event studies in determining disgorgement. A 1994 article by SEC staffers Mark Mitchell and Jeffrey Netter stated, quote, "The SEC recently began to use stock price evidence to show materiality in securities fraud cases, especially insider trading cases. Statistical tests of significance are useful both in establishing materiality and in calculating disgorgement," end quote. In conclusion, the discretion afforded to the district courts in determining disgorgement awards gives defendants an opportunity to contest the SEC's disgorgement methodology. This is also consistent with the concept of an equitable remedy, where the defense can persuasively demonstrate that net economic gains are lower than the SEC's calculation. It may be able to reduce or eliminate liability.
Thank you, Elaine. That was fascinating and raised some interesting questions that we'll deal with in a general discussion following the other presentations. We turn next to Dr. Patrick Conroy for enlightenment on the much-in-the-news subject of options backdating. Patrick?
Thank you. It is much in the news. In fact, I noticed this morning it was the first morning it wasn't on one of the front pages of one of the sections of the Wall Street Journal. But the New York Times kept the streak going, so they kept it on the front page of their business section. Since it's the historical society of the SEC, I thought I would just start off with a little bit of my own history, which kind of was apropos to it. I worked at the SEC for a few years in the late 90s, and I always used to root around down in the library. And one time I came across kind of an old school report, pre-word processors from the 60s. It was beautifully handwritten on regular typewritten paper, and then it had graph paper with all the graphs hand-drawn and everything. And oddly enough, it was on options grants to executives of major companies in the 60s.
Oh, my.
So, I don't think this is a new issue of what's going on and how people feel about options, and certainly all of this backdating has simply brought it to the forefront. But let's start off really quickly with what an option is, and since we're not drawing pictures, I just want to describe a few of the terms. Most people know with the prevalence of them in the 90s that a call option gives you the right to buy securities or to buy stock. And the benefit of that is you have the right to buy it but not the obligation to buy it. So a strike price is set, say, $5. And if the current price is 10, then you have the opportunity to buy something for $5, which is worth 10, which is a good thing. And then you can sell it for 10. And a lot of terms are thrown around, like intrinsic value and strike price and vesting period. And all of these terms are simply how the option is defined. The strike price is the price that is set in which you can exercise it out. The time is the amount of time you have till the option expires. The vesting period is set by the company for the employees in when they're allowed to exercise these options. And typically, during the time period everyone is talking about, they were exercisable over 4 years. So if you received the grant of 10,000 shares, you might only be able to actually vest 2,500 per year for 4 years. And that was common, because not only are you hoping that the price goes up, but they want you to have a long-term connection to the company in terms of vesting it. So there's usually a picture which looks kind of like a hockey stick, and so as the price goes up, you're able to make more money. Why did people make huge sums of money off of this? Well, if you read the paper today in Brodkade, some of the options were strike price was maybe 20 or 30 cents per share. And when the price was $133 a share, clearly that's all profit and very valuable to the person who's holding those. So what's all the backdating about? Well, we can call it backdating. We could also just call it back pricing. the date's really irrelevant. The fact of the matter is that simply they're taking a price which is not the current price. So when the options are being granted, the committee which is granting them gets together. The current price of the stock could be $10, and they can look back in the past and say, gee, you know what, a couple months ago it was $5, let's set the price at $5. Now, from talking about these intrinsic value and strike price, if I have the current price as $10 in the market, but I'm setting your strike price at $5, you're already $5 in the money. So you've actually made a $5 profit per share, kind of. Your stock is not vested, so you can't go out and really do anything with it. So you have that sitting there waiting for you. So it's back pricing. Is there anything wrong with setting a price which is below the current price for the strike price? Again, not really. You can do it as long as you tell people that's what you're doing and they understand it. And I think that's the crux of the problem we have now, which is what these companies have done is set the strike price lower than the current price at the time they granted the option. But instead of letting the public investors realize that there's $5 profit built into that, it appears that they were at the money. In other words, it appears that both the strike price and the price on the day at which the option was set was $5. That's the problem we're getting into now. How do we deal with this in terms of the accounting? What are people looking for and what are they upset about? What is this? It's a violation of GAAP. It's a violation in GAAP because it's a compensation expense and it should have been expensed off of people's net income had they counted for it correctly. Let me give you a quick example. Suppose a company has revenue of $1,000. If they granted options when the current price of the stock was $10, with a strike price of $10 on that day, it's not taken as a compensation expense. So if I were simply deducting that as their only expense off of their revenue, their pre-tax net income would still be $1,000. However, take a scenario where that company granted the same number of options, however, backdated the strike price to $5, which occurred, say, a month earlier. Now, the amount in the money at $500 would have to be taken off of revenue. And therefore, pre-tax net income fell by $500. What's going to happen in the cases going forward is these companies are starting to have to look in how they're going to restate. Was it the case that they were giving employees compensation and giving them compensation expense, which they should have taken off of net income, which they didn't? Why is that important? Well, consider yourself as an investor during this time in which you're purchasing a security and you think the earnings are X. In fact, they were less than X simply because the company didn't take off the compensation expense correctly. Now, there are nuances to this. Companies are allowed to deduct compensation expense if it is performance-based. But there are nuances in terms of it being greater than or less than $1 million and other issues which are going to affect in the long run whether or not the company would have to restate. So what happens when a company has done backdating of options and not accounted for it correctly? Their compensation expense was actually higher than they told you. Their net income was actually lower than they told you. Their shares outstanding didn't change because the option grant of the number of shares stays the same. But their earnings per share has actually fallen. Oddly enough, there can be no cash change to this simply because of the way it's accounted for. How was all this discovered? Well, as usual, it was simply an academic who was looking through. It's not easy to tell if options have been backdated off of the financial statements of a company. So they ran a statistical procedure to estimate how likely was it that these options grants which were occurring could have occurred at the prices where they were. And what they found was an inordinate portion of the time these took place at the lowest possible price. And many people will have read in the paper by now calculating odds of that of 1,000,000 to 1 or 1,000,000,000 to 1 or what have you. But it was simply statistically very unlikely that randomly they had been able to pick all of the lowest prices. That's where the paper came out. And I think it was actually several years ago and people had been working on it since then. How are these suits going to progress? Well, it's interesting. Statistically, a lot of times there seems to be very little price reaction from the announcement. not necessarily the first companies that come out with it, because there's a stigma associated with the options backdating. But in general, as economists, as investors, what you look for is the discounted value of future cash flow. So let's take a company which, for instance, had backdated their options. Is this, at this point in time, going to change their future cash flow? The answer is probably no. In addition, while there may be some companies where the dollar value of this is huge, instance Brocade, there are many companies that would have fairly small dollar value in changes in net income due to their options vesting. So some of these suits may become 10b-5, securities class actions, but many likely will become derivative suits. Finally, I mean, one question that keeps coming up in the press that we read about is the incentive. What incentives do stock options really give people? That's a difficult question to answer. I think there have been academic studies on both sides. Some people will tell you, regardless, if you give someone money, if you give someone securities which are in the money, they still have an incentive to have the stock price go even higher. It seems to have changed recently as stock options have fallen out of favor that people are getting shares of restricted stock. If you think about a share of restricted stock, instead of now giving them something which gives them the opportunity to benefit in the future, by giving them restricted stock, you've actually given them the money plus the option to benefit in the future if they choose to hold the stock. So, like most things, come in and out of fad, stock options have gone out. They're being replaced somewhat by restricted stock, but it remains to be seen whether that's going to create the same incentives that stock options did during their heyday.
Thank you, Patrick. I learned a great deal from that. Once again, we'll hold off on questions until after the final presentation, which will be made by Dr. Fadhan Sabri on the subject of mutual fund advisory fees. Fadhan, you're last, but certainly not least.
Thank you. The main question that I'm addressing is what determines how much money is paid to the advisor or management company of a mutual fund. This question is really at the heart of a lot of litigation on fees. It's also of interest to regulators, has been of considerable interest to Mr. Spitzer, and, of course, is of interest to the shareholders of mutual funds. According to the latest statistics, more than half of the U.S. households invest in mutual funds directly or indirectly through retirement plans. So I guess many of the people listening in today are probably investing at least some of their savings in mutual funds. And for those who do, I wonder how many of them do know how fees and expenses of funds are determined, or more specifically, how much of the, how much the advisory or the management of the fund get paid. These are the main questions that I will address in the next few minutes. I'll start with a very brief introduction of mutual funds, how they are structured. I really believe that the legal structure of mutual fund has a lot to do with why advisory fees is even an issue to start with. I'll then briefly discuss the different types of fees and expenses. I'll explain the various determinants of fees that came out of an analysis we did and a database that NERAS put together from public filings of mutual funds. And if there's any time, I'll briefly describe some recent changes in regulation regarding disclosure of fees. A typical mutual fund is organized basically by a sponsor who expects to profit by providing advisory and other services to the fund. The fund itself is usually set up as a corporation, sometimes as an investment trust or other forms of, and it's managed by or under the director of its own board of directors. So what the sponsor does is he chooses the initial board, which enters into a management contract with the fund by which it provides advisory services. So the mutual funds are really externally managed. The fund itself has few or no employees of its own. And the main role of the board of directors is to be sort of a watchdog, looking out for the interest of investors. So when you and I invest in a mutual fund, we're buying shares or buying a portion of the mutual fund, and we are the shareholders of the fund. The board of directors basically negotiate. They oversee the fund's activities. The main thing they do is really approve and negotiate the contract with the advisor and the other services providers to the fund. There are many other players in the structure of a mutual fund, but these are really the key ones that are relevant to our discussion today. So what fees am I talking about, and what do mutual funds get in return for these fees? The main line item on in the expenses of any mutual fund is really their management fees or advisory fees. A mutual fund pays this money to an advisor or a management company, and I will use these terms interchangeably, in return for portfolio management. The advisor conducts research, makes fund investment decisions, does a lot of the shareholder servicing, holds the shareholder meetings and issue and cancel share certifications and the like. There are other types of fees and expenses that a mutual fund incur. For example, there are distribution fees, and known as 12b1. These are fees that are paid for marketing and advertising. There are other types of expenses related to shareholder services, like a toll-free number and computerized account services. These line items, when they add them up, they reflect the operating expenses of a fund. The way the norm in this industry is to present these expenses as, or to express them as, a ratio of the total net asset of a fund. For example, you will see in the prospectus that are mailed to investors a number saying total operating expense is 1.2%. What they really mean is 1.2% of the total net assets of that fund. Another way expressed in this industry is to say the total operating expense is 120 basis points. They are used to mean the same thing. Now, using this database of over 9,000 mutual funds, if you look at the composition of their operating expenses, you will find that regardless of the type of that fund or its size, the advisory fees constitute the single largest line item of their expenses, regardless of whether it's a bond fund or an equity fund, and it's usually about half of all operating expenses go to paying the management company or the advisor of the fund. What NERA did in order to examine these fees a little bit more and try to figure out what determines how the fees are set, we collected the public filings of all mutual funds known as the NSAR forms that were filed from 1992 to 2005. According to law, each mutual fund is required to file two NSAR forms, one covering the first part of the year and another covering the full year. And we collected all these filings, and so we would have data on the fund composition of each fund, the trading activity, the type, the size of the funds, the assets under management, and more importantly, and most relevant to this fees issue, is we have data on the structure of the contracts that are set between the mutual funds and the advisors. And when we examined the actual fee rates for all equity funds in our database, we find that the median is about 75 basis points or 0.75%. But we also notice a lot of variation in the fees. So there are mutual funds that pay their advisors something less than 20 basis points, and others pay on the other extreme. They pay something above 160 to 180 basis points, which is, so the variation is astounding, really, and it begs the point of what explains this difference. And our analysis of the database shows that there are several factors related that can help explain advisory fees. One factor has to do with risk. Mutual funds come in different flavors of risk. On the one extreme of very low risk, we have the bond funds, income funds. These are funds that focus mainly on receipt of income as an investment strategy. And then on the other extreme, we have funds that focus solely on short-term appreciation through high-risk investments, and these are called the capital appreciation funds. And as you would expect, the riskier the fund, the more costly it is to manage. So a bond fund would pay an advisor on average 50 basis points or 0.5% of their total net assets as fees, whereas the capital appreciation could pay anything in the range of 90 to 100 basis points to manage their funds. So that's one element or one factor that can explain the variation of these fees that we observe in the data. Another factor is size, and this also is an issue, a big issue in the litigation. As the funds grow in size, we do see that their fees decline from maybe something in the range of 75 basis points for a fund that's of a small size, which is $100 million in that industry, to 45 basis points for a fund that's in the billions of dollars. So this whole issue speaks to the economies of scale, which is as the funds grow in size, as a fund, for example, a mutual fund doubles in size from $500 million to $1 billion, the cost of doing research and managing the portfolio doesn't necessarily double with it. So you should expect to see if there are economies of scale and they are being passed on to the investors, that you should see the fees going down as the funds grow in size. Another important factor, which I think is that we can capture with this database, is the structure of the contract. There are different ways that a mutual fund can structure the incentives for the advisor. So a contract with an advisor can be based solely on the assets under management, and this is really what most mutual funds do. Or it could be based on performance or relative performance. Within the contracts based on assets only, a fund can agree to pay a flat fee, and that's we'll pay you, the mutual fund would tell the advisor, okay, we'll pay you 70 basis points no matter how much our assets grow, or they would agree on breakpoints. And the way breakpoints work is simply as the fund grows in size, the mutual fund agrees with the advisor that they will reduce the fee. If you look at the data, we have data on the contractual fees, what they agreed on, and what they actually ended up paying. If you look at the data of the fees as set in the contract, it does appear to be if the mutual fund agrees on breakpoints, that they are getting a good deal, contractually at least. But, and here's the interesting twist, is that when we look at the actual fees paid, it's not clear that a mutual fund is necessarily paying more if they agree on a flat fee contract versus a breakpoint fee. The issue is a little bit more complicated than just looking at one dimension of the structure of the contract. So what do we conclude from that? We conclude that in order to really figure out how fees are assessed or determined, one has to control or take into account various factors such as the number and quality of services offered, the performance, and I would say risk-adjusted performance, and whether there are economies of scale, the incentives, structure of the contract, of the advisor, and, of course, the investment style and risk.
Thank you. That was quite informative. We'll turn now to the discussion part of the program. I have a few questions, more than a few, suggested by each of your topics, as well as some general questions. I'd encourage each of you to weigh in on each question and react to one another as you see fit. First, in the area of disgorgement, Elaine, you made it clear that courts traditionally have been very interested in strict causal relationships between the act of wrongdoing and the amount to be disgorged. And at the same time, you indicated that the purpose of the disgorgement remedy is deterrence. Why not err then on the side of ordering disgorgement of all subsequent profit, as opposed to being so interested in exactly how much is attributable to the wrongdoing?
So, for example, if we were looking at McDonald's, why don't you also take all the profit profits for 2 weeks on insider information and then makes most of his money on the subsequent year, and why not ask for everything?
Exactly.
disgorgement, first of all, is an equitable remedy, and its equitable roots go back to basically, you know, British common law. So as long as you are in the disgorgement world, that's what you're asking for. However, one can impose penalties. So, for example, against sticking with insider trading, penalties can be up to treble the disgorgement amount. So you could be asked for disgorgement plus three times disgorgement. So the disgorgement is intended to send the message that you just can't keep your profits. And then the penalty option available to the judge is designed to capture the punitive aspect.
And
it's a two-part approach.
And to make sure that the defendants don't go into it just thinking, well, I've got nothing to lose here by trying it. All they can do is take away my profit. There
right.
is something.
To be candid, the courts will often, the penalty will often be set as a function of what there is the capacity to pay.
That seems reasonable. Now, I'm interested in pursuing for a few minutes the theme of incentive effects, and here there was the deterrent effect of disgorgement. In the area of stock options, I think that, Patrick, you did make some comments having to do with the interaction of backdating and the options and the incentives that are given to executives to do the best possible for their company. Does it seem to you that backdating ruins the incentive effect of stock options?
Look, there are academic studies that might even suggest that having some money in already actually increases the incentive. But, I mean, in general, like, we all have different, in economics term, utility function. We all decide what is important to us. Clearly, we read in the news of people who have already made hundreds of millions of dollars who are still interested in making more. So it seems that they still seem to have an incentive to make more money. So I think, you know, unless you're so far out that stuff doesn't matter to you at all anymore, everyone has an additional incentive. Also, at some level, there are people who simply have the incentive to see their company do well, and being compensated for that as part of just being part of the market. We're always going to fall back on the argument of our executives or even regular people overcompensated, or were they overcompensated in this area? I mean, we can go down to the fact that there were people during the internet boom at companies right out here in Dulles, Virginia, who probably started in positions upon which they became millionaires, where in other companies they never would have had that opportunity. Were they overcompensated? Did they lose their incentive? I don't know. So I think in a raw mathematical way, it says, sure, you have less incentive because you're simply wealthier because you have part of your money there. But I was alluding to restricted stock, because restricted stock is simply giving one the actual equity with some restrictions on when and when they cannot sell it. And some of the anecdotal evidence is people are favoring that now over options because of all the bad press options has gotten. But clearly companies feel that's still an incentive to be a part owner and, you know, to have a keen individual interest in the profit stream and cash flow of the company.
It does sound to me, from what you said, that there isn't any indication really at all that issuers who backdated options at some time in the past were underperformers vis-a-vis other similar companies.
I think that will be the crux of all of the damage analysis to come, is I think that is a salient question. Even after all of the backdating comes to forefront and you see what happened when, the question is going to become, how would it affected it at that time, meaning if it had changed income of the company. Suppose companies wouldn't have been able to get key employees because they weren't able to offer options. And clearly the backdated options in the first place were in part, in some ways, Microsoft did it in the 90s and then stopped the practice. You didn't want to hire two people, one on Monday and one on Friday, and have them have a difference in compensation of $100,000. And have them be disgruntled. So maybe you would give them the average or the low over the 30 days to try and smooth those things out. So I don't think these were always nefarious reasons. In fact, part of it may have been just to align people together.
Very interesting. Now, the theme of incentive that's shared by disgorgement and stock options, I think also is would clearly be relevant in the area of mutual fund advisory fees. Fadan, it seemed from your presentation that there is relatively little use of incentive compensation in the mutual fund area. Is that a correct reading? And if so, what explains it?
Well, there is. I think this could be, some academics argue that this is the case, that this is the reason why, and the reason behind that is because the way the industry is structured is you have the sponsor setting up a mutual fund and then to basically profit, and then the board of directors that is picked by the presumably sponsor are expected to negotiate with the sponsor or with the management company about about fees. That's on one side. There are some academics who argue that, and then there are others who say, wait a minute, there are 40% of these board of directors have to be independent by law under the Investment Act of 1940. And even the SEC even tried in 2004 to issue a ruling requiring that not just 40, but 75% of the board of directors have to be independent. The rule has been since overruled, and the SEC is soliciting comments at this point. And I think up until the end of August, the industry still has some time to respond to that. So there is the issue of that 40%, at least now 40% of the directors are independent, but it's still a little bit complicated because the advisor is providing a product that has multiple attributes to it. The advisor, really, because the mutual fund itself has no employees, the advisor really makes or breaks the fund. He's the performance. If the fund succeeds, it becomes the advisor has a lot to do with the success of that fund, it seems to me. So I think that there are reasons to think there are enough incentives, and I think enough incentives now in place for the advisor to do the right thing. Besides, the contract is renewed every year. They negotiate it every year, and now with the new regulations, they are about disclosure. The mutual fund has to disclose the reasons for setting up the fees the way they did. So.
Let me approach that from another angle. If you look at the difference between fee contracts, which are flat fee, regardless of the assets under management, and those with breakpoints, in other words, the percentage fee declines with the assets under management, those have different incentives. Essentially, the flat fee offers higher incentives. So let's think initially about a fund that has $1 billion in assets under management. And let's assume for a moment that they're not taking any, for one reason or another, they're either not taking new shareholders or they get no shareholders in a year, but they make a 25% return, right? Then that means that next year, with the exact same shareholders, they get to make 25% more. However, if instead you have breakpoints, so let's assume that originally you get 1%, and if you, on $1 billion you get 1%, but on $1.25 billion you get 0.9%, well, the upside incentive and the increase in income to the managers is lesser in this concept under breakpoints. The same thing applies if you think not just about the growth and the size of the fund due to the investment decisions, but also a well-performing fund will grow even more rapidly because it'll attract additional investors who look favorably on the track record of the managers, despite that constant disclaimer that past performance is not an indication of future returns. So really, the differences in the flat fee versus the breakpoint fee structure really speaks to how much incentive you want to give to your fund managers.
I'll add only one thing, which is the management company almost never gets fired. I think I only know of one instance ever where the board of directors, or in recent history, has switched management companies.
And it made it to the New York Times front page.
Right. Other than that, the trustees don't have options to negotiate, and then they have a nuclear bomb, which is we're going to fire you as our management company. And so there's not a lot in between for them to work with.
Do you know if there's much information available about the profitability of the management companies themselves? Is what are their profit margins?
Publicly? I don't think there's a lot publicly available.
I mean, first of all, a lot of funds are actually farmed out to several different sub-managers rather than just one manager or advisor. Sometimes they're part of public companies, but they'll be, you know, a small part of the public company. Other times they're privately held, and so it probably wouldn't be public.
It wouldn't be surprising, though, to think that the directors of the mutual fund would be interested in making inquiry into the subject when they're negotiating, so perhaps it's addressed that way.
I think now they have to, according to there are new rules now regarding disclosure of fees that specifically the SEC said you have to disclose as a mutual fund the basis for choosing your fees and how you selected it, what other comparative fee structures you looked at, and why you picked the fees you did. So I think we'll see now in the most recent filings of the funds what they say about that.
So you introduced your talk with a reference to recent changes. Have there been any others that are particularly noteworthy?
Well, there was the 75% independent ruling that was overturned, and it's now the SEC soliciting comments. So we'll see if this will be enacted or not. But these are the two main rules. But there's, in terms of regulation, this was it.
Significant. Yeah. Speaking of current events, I'm wondering what effect Sarbanes-Oxley had, and I guess it's not that recent, but it's still much in the news and on people's minds, what effect that had on each of the areas that you, Elaine, and you, Patrick, talked about. Elaine, any effect on disgorgement?
Well, as I said, Sarbanes-Oxley makes the disgorgement remedy, which was always available to the SEC, mandatory in a lot of cases. And the SEC used it substantially in insider trading. Historically, probably used it less in the areas of corporate fraud and going after the gains to executives. Now they have to. Sarbanes-Oxley states that in any case where you have a restatement due to material misrepresentation, or in other words, a restatement due to inappropriate decisions and wrongdoing, which are all your restatements that cause securities fraud scandals, large or small, the CEO and CFO must be forced to disgorge all their incentive-based compensation. So this basically means that every time you have some sort of fraudulent restatement, the SEC is now going to be compelled to bring these cases. So it's going to be a much more common remedy, and that's why we thought it was interesting to start thinking and talking about the methodology for calculating disgorgement that is truly equitable and truly captures the net effect for the executives. Because what we try to do with the net economic gains approach is to capture the effect that while if you consider a multi-year securities fraud, for example, and you think just about bonuses, if you have an earnings formula that's a function of earnings per share growth, a bonus formula that's a function of earnings per share growth, in principle you could have higher growth and higher bonuses in some years, but as compared to the alternative, the way the earnings actually get restated, you might have done better in certain years had you just been telling the truth. And you need to net the additional income in the years where you make more against the lost income in other years. Similarly, if you think about an executive that is both buying and selling in the company's stock over the time period, sales presumably at an inflated price, if there's accounting fraud, will have incremental profit associated with the fraud. However, if there are any purchases, they would be buying into inflation and harming each other, and those can be netted either against the profits from stock sales or against incremental bonus income.
Pat, how about the effect on options backdating?
Well, in a backward kind of way, SOX actually helped provide evidence towards backdating. Imagine if you took the price at which options were granted pre-Sarbanes-Oxley and you looked at the price immediately before that and immediately after that. The picture looks somewhat like a V. The price before the grant was falling and then the price after the grant was rising and somewhat steeply. When Sarbanes-Oxley was enacted, it changed the rule. Pre-Sarbanes-Oxley, the company didn't need to announce until 45 days after the close of the fiscal year information about backdating. Sarbanes-Oxley changed that to 2 days. And so if you do that same exercise, which was done by an academic study, that you take the days on which the options were granted in the post-Sarbanes-Oxley and look at the price before and after, trying to see whether it was granted at a low, it looks almost like a horizontal line. And so there's a stark difference between those two pictures. When they had to report within 2 days, it gave them very little leeway towards going back in time, finding a lower price, and essentially cut it out. There is some slight difference between the companies that did it reported within 2 days and 1 day. So people, I think, will always try and find whatever small advantage there is to them.
That's interesting. Fafin, you mentioned, of course, that there have been lawsuits alleging that mutual fund some mutual fund advisory fees have been excessive. How do you know what? How does one know what excessive is, and who should be deciding those issues?
That's a good question. Excessive, I think, what excessive fees are have been determined by the court in a seminal case of that's known as the Gartenberg versus Merrill Lynch case that was in the early 80s, where the shareholders of mutual funds sued and alleged that the fees, alleged, for example, first that the board of directors have breached their fiduciary duty, that the fees that the shareholders are paying, the fees that they are paying to the advisors are excessive. And the court rejected that, and the test, and that I'm quoting from the court's decision, is that the fee schedule has to represent arm's length negotiation, and it has to take into consideration all the surrounding or different factors that have since become known as the Gartenberg factors. There are six of them, and they are, basically they include the nature and the quality of the services provided by the advisor, profitability of the fund, economies of scale, the comparative fee structures, how the fees of this fund compares to the relevant comparables, and then the independence of the directors themselves. And a lot of the plaintiffs have the burden of proof, and they have had a hard time since then getting some of these cases past the first the motion to dismiss case, but some of them have, and there are currently several ongoing fees litigation where the case, I think, has gone beyond the motion to dismiss, and it's going to be litigated further. There's no economic definition for excessive fees, but it's other than to say that it has to be the result of an arm's length negotiation between the fund and the advisor.
And looking at it in hindsight, with the benefit of those factors, basically tells you whether the process was appropriate.
I'm not sure that's. I think the process would be appropriate.
Yeah,
it makes sense. Yes.
Is this primarily an issue in cases where there is some sort of self-dealing that's alleged, or some sort of back scratching?
I think these cases are all filed under Section 36B, which has to do with, the fiduciary duty of the board of directors didn't do their job, basically, by they didn't negotiate with the interest of the shareholders in mind, that they didn't get the best fee that they could have, or where you can define the fee not just the amount paid, but also the kind of services that the advisor would offer. Alone, because not all advisors offer the same types and the same quality of services as others.
Going back to you, Elaine, you used the term event study in your presentation. I was wondering if you could give me and other listeners more of a feel for what an event study is.
An event study is a statistical analysis of the stock price reaction, or if you're looking at index or mutual price of some other security, to news. So, first of all, one generally starts out by looking at history and performing a regression analysis of the reaction of the stock price to other market indicators. You might look at the market overall, some index like the S&P 500 or the NASDAQ. You might also look at its responsiveness to its industry or its cohorts in the market. And then you look at how much that gives you an ability, based on past experience, to predict how the stock would move in response to that day's movements and whatever factors you've looked at, the S&P 500, the industry index, so on. Then you look at a day when the news is announced. You can say what history would have predicted into the stock price movement that day. So let's suppose that you announce terrible earnings on a day that there's also a fabulous unemployment announcement by the federal government. And so the market overall is up, and your stock is generally correlated positively to the market overall. So that would predict, let's say, a 1% positive return for the stock. But you announce this terrible return, and the stock price actually goes down 3%. You'd expect up 1, you get down 3. So the impact of the market is essentially roughly 4. That's an oversimplification of the statistical analysis, but that's it. It enables you to separate out the movement due to the news from other market movements in the day and really say, what is the loss due to the fraud on that day?
And Patrick, is that the kind of information that you were alluding to when you said that there didn't seem to be much of a market reaction when companies had announced backdating?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, really, the work really remains to be done as there are new companies coming out. And constructing what Elaine's talking about, an event study, requires really looking carefully at what indexes and what peer companies should be used in order to predict the future price. So that takes a lot of work. Right now, so far, most people have looked at the raw price reaction, and the raw price reaction is probably somewhat smaller than people would imagine it would be, even though there are outliers. We haven't adjusted those for the market on given days that it went out. So it could turn out, like Elaine's example, either way. It could be that you announce bad news on a day in which the market is down, thus muting the bad effect, or you could announce it on a day in which the market is up and thus amplifying what looks like the bad effect. Either way, what you're really trying to figure out is, in a Dura kind of way, which is, when you disclose something, is it a relevant disclosure to whatever the fraud or the bad act was supposed to be? And in that disclosure, was the price reaction significant? Was it not a random price movement, or was it something that you can say was probably tied to the news that was announced on that day?
Is it possible to engage in some gamesmanship with respect to announcements, knowing how event studies are constructed, that is, come out with your bad news on a day when other bad things are happening in the market? Or
you could try and do that. Even simpler, though, is to announce bad news. For instance, you could announce that you have to restate due to some accounting problem you had, and on that same day announce that future earnings are going to be lower than you thought they were. And what you'll wind up with is a price reaction, which then someone has to go back and try and separate it out. Or alternatively, you could announce that you're going to have to restate something on a day when you announce excellent news. And so overall, the price reaction goes up, but the down is being masked by the up. And both plaintiff attorneys and defense attorneys are very good at trying to get their point of view out of what the real price reaction was.
Sounds like challenging work sorting it out.
Mm.
Well, I think we have time for perhaps one more quick question. And I guess, Pat, this one's going to go to you too, I think. With respect to the idea of backdating options but dragging out the vesting period, are companies entitled to take into account the time value of the discount? That is, it's not worth as much to the employee because it doesn't vest differently. Does that have any effect on the accounting or the issues?
No, I don't think it actually has an effect on the accounting, but actually there's a group at NERA and many people who work on simply valuing employee stock options because, as you point out, they have many different components to them in terms of vesting, registration, that a normal option may not have. It's more complicated to correctly value an employee stock option. There are also different times. There's straight options, there's ISO options, and different ways people execute them. So I think there is a discipline that's different from simply valuing plain vanilla options in the market and valuing employee options. And I'm no doubt that all that will come into play when trying to figure out what the effect of the backdating was.
Elaine Patton-Fotten, thank you for sharing these presentations from Neura Economic Consulting's Finance, Law, and Security Seminar. I can see why they and you were rated top presentations and presenters. Today's fireside chat is now archived by audio tape at www.sechistorical.org. The transcript of the chat will be ready soon. I'll return in September for our final fireside chat for 2006, talking with Donald Langevoort, Thomas Aquinas Reynolds, Professor of Law at Georgetown Law Center, a member of the Society's Board of Advisors, and the inaugural moderator for the Fireside Chats in 2004. Don will discuss behavioral economics, the links between psychology and economics, and how cognitive and emotional processes influence our rational or irrational economic decisions. It promises to be a very interesting discussion. Please join us on Tuesday, September 19th at 3 p.m. Eastern Time at www.sechistorical.org. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.